I would like briefly to outline five things that I'd like to try to do today. And although five sounds like a lot of things to do in a short period of time, some of these are rather short, and then hopefully most of the time, or a great deal of the time, can be devoted to discussion. But the title is, What Kind of a Revival Are We In Today? And within that, I would like to discuss, first of all, why I think it is a distinctive movement, why we can set it apart from other kinds of renewal and resurgence movements that have taken place in our memory and way back into earlier American history. I think that's an important thing, because it seems to many people like sort of a hodgepodge of many different kinds of activities. Do you want to get the door, Nick? And secondly, you know, what kind of evidence do we have? What specific kind of evidence? I don't have pottery or anything, but I do have some kind of evidence that there is a distinctive movement going on. I've got some artifacts. And third, I'd like to tie it in with some of the things that we were talking about yesterday, how the revival today is in one way distinctive, but in another way is part of the general cultural scene and the thrusts of some of the other larger movements that are taking place in our day. And then I would like to give a brief evaluation myself, just very briefly, of this, because I would much rather get your ideas on this and listen to myself talk about the things I've already decided about myself, when I might have decided myself. I after 22 years, you get tired of listening to yourself, believe it or not. And even though I come from the land of Hubert Humphrey, who never did seem, you know, anyway, to do that, I always like to say that I was always sympathetic towards Humphrey, because we both talked too fast, and neither of us knew when to quit. And therefore, he's been rather close and sort of a role model for me. And then finally, as a fifth, I would like to have questions, comments, evaluations from you, because that's for what I'd like to bring this together as a discussion, and not just as a one-to-one. If somebody wants to disagree with somebody over here and there, that's fine. I would much rather have it, you know, be a community thing rather than just a one-to-one here and then back and forth all the way through. I would like to discuss, first of all, then the idea that there is a very distinctive kind of resurgence or renewal movement taking place within the United States today, and I think I can identify seven or eight characteristics of the movement which, when taken together, separated out from other kinds of religious movements that are taking place at the same time. This is kind of academic stuff, but that's the only way I can start by way of, you know, of a foundation for this. And I say this because in the manuscript itself, I put together two people who, I'm sure if you know the backgrounds, would strike you as not necessarily being in the same movement. I put Maribel Morgan and Bill Gothard together in the same movement. Now, if you know Maribel and if you know Gothard, in lifestyles, you know, they're light years away. But in other ways, they're really quite close, and I would like to discuss in what way these all these different characteristics seem to sort of come together. First of all, with the revival, if you want to call it that today, I'd rather call it sort of a resurgence or a renewal movement. There's no question but that it starts with an affirmation of the Bible as the final norm of authority of God's will. It's first and last the Bible movement and a dependence on the Bible for the final authority. In all the debates and the discussions that are going on over gays, over family, over divine order, over whatever it might be, the person who comes up with the best exegesis on an issue is the one who's sort of won the argument. The only trouble is that there's no agreement over who's come up with the best exegesis. If you've written, if you've read some of the books of Virginia Mollenkopf, for instance, or Aletha Scanzoni, you will see that they take on the establishment in the evangelical circles, you know, head on. And if we'd like to get into that, that would be fun, I think. I think a second characteristic of the movement, besides the reliance on the Bible as the final authority, and by that I mean they don't rely on, you know, behavioral science or social science or other kinds of incense, but the Bible as the final authority, they have a common adversary, or a common enemy, if you'd like to say, in theological and political liberalism. That's very important. In other words, they know what they're against. Sometimes comes out in a new form that I've picked out and I want to talk about a little bit later in the Christian school movement. It comes out as something called secular humanism. which seems to be a term which is a catch-all, but which is kind of a code term that many people understand. And if you say secular humanism, those who are into the movement understand what you mean, and there's virtually unanimous agreement on what secular humanism really means, instead of the old bugaboo of liberalism, which was the code word, you know, in the 1960s. It was so interesting when I was going around talking about it was the first book, The Fundamentalists on the Far Right. It was like playing an organ. Because I would you know, like push a key and I would say Martin Luther King, or I would say National Council of Churches, or I would say Eugene Carson Blake, and I knew from the audience, you know, exactly what sound I would get back with this, because the code word was such that everybody understood what was the right thing, you know, to say in terms of this sort of thing. All right, so we've got the Bible as the final norm of authority. We've got a common adversary in this new thing called secular humanism. It could be called liberalism, political or theological, but basically I think the other one. Third, in a very important part of the movement, and I want to talk about this in some detail, is that the movement, by comparison to earlier revivals, with a couple of exceptions, is led by very appealing spokesmen with very high visibility, especially in the mass media. This is something new, that we have superstars in the movement itself who cultivate the idea of coming on as a very appealing kind of personality in whom one can have confidence, and that much of the strength of the movement rests in this rather than in having a sort of a parish-wide or a denomination-wide kind of movement. But every specific cause that I'll be talking about has at least one significant and highly skilled spokesman who seems to be able to attract a certain audience with a great deal of loyalty and enthusiasm. And as I've suggested, I think fourth, it's a movement because with any movement there is sort of an insider's language, a certain set of words, a certain code, so to speak, that means certain things to the believers in the movement, which don't necessarily mean the same thing to believers outside of the movement. You can find this in politics, you can find this in theology, you can find this in educational jargon. It's a jargon, is really what I'm saying, is that the movement has its own jargon. And that this isn't necessarily bad. Sometimes jargon is a very easy and helpful shortcut to explaining ideas which otherwise would be rather difficult for other people to understand. And I think fifthly, the evangelical resurgence today is an organized movement because it's more than simply a talk or a preaching kind of activity or program that's going on. They have very specific programs. Some of these are very, very well organized. Probably one of the best examples of this would be the Christian school movement, which, I want to talk about, in which you can buy books now. You know, in America we have the how-to craze, and I've got several books, How to Start Your Own School, which may drive state boards of education crazy, but because there isn't much on accreditation, but it's very much action-oriented. And that's a rather distinctive and unique kind of feature that they have that I think is important. Sixth, I think there's a rather clearly defined code of ethics, so to speak, or of moral behavior, by which one can order one's life with this. There's a fairly clear understanding throughout the movement, with some exceptions that I'll be talking about, by comparison to, you know, traditional sort of middle-class consumer Americans all the way through. I think another part of the revival or the renewal that we're in today is that, with a few important exceptions, and they are very important exceptions, such as the Sojourners, and I hope you read the magazine we have, the Sojourners here, or the other side, and all the rest. Most of the movement itself tends to be very conservative so far as its social and political economic outlook is concerned. I heard, for instance, when we had the rally about the gay referendum in St. Paul, Bob Green, Anita's husband, came, and he said, never forget it, he said, "The people who are with us are the people who want to hang on to the Panama Canal." And I was trying to figure out gay rights and Panama Canal, and I'm still working on that one. I haven't got quite together. That was before the Senate vote on the Panama Canal. But there is, with a few, as I say, important exceptions. The Sojourners would certainly be one, with Jim Wallace and the others, and others. We take them, I see over here at the library, the other side, and other important ones like this. And finally, something that's usually overlooked in the evangelical resurgence today, and I hate to use big words here, and I'll try to break them down, but almost all adhere in one form or another to what we call a premillennial view of the end times. The doctrines of, or what we call eschatology, death, judgment, resurrection, and eternity, almost all believe that in one form or another the end times are very near. And that this gives a certain kind of cohesion and sometimes an impetus and sometimes a kind of a fright to the movement, if you want to put it that way, that you don't find in many of the other renewal movements that are taking place in the church. But when you put these seven or eight characteristics together, I think you can say, as I'm trying to argue in the book, that there is a kind of a cohesion here, and that most of the people, with maybe a few exceptions, would accept these kinds of commitments and these characteristics that I've talked about there. At the same time that is said, it also has to be said that there is an enormous amount of diversity within the movement itself. There is a Young Turk movement within the movement itself, and the book which I had on the board yesterday, Richard Quibido's The Young Evangelicals, talks at great length about this. At some of the seminaries, Fuller is an example of this. In others, there is a strong movement to break away from some of the older traditional ideas. And this is especially true in the whole question of inerrancy of Scripture, in which the historical critical method of interpreting the Bible is creeping in making a great deal of difference, especially over the question of divine order and what Paul meant about, you know, wives being in submission and so on and so forth. So there is, you know, there is diversity with that. But I think that would be my brief discussion here of why I think this is a distinctive movement which you can set apart from, say, the charismatic movement, or the liturgical renewal movement, or the simple living movement, or some of the other movements that are taking place in the church. When you put these together, there is overlap. There's no question there's overlap. There are charismatics who are in the movement, and then there are charismatics who are out of the movement. The Southern Baptists, for instance, would be a very good example of this, who are certainly strongly into evangelical revival and evangelical resurgence, who have taken a very strong stand against the charismatic movement. The Missouri Synod has officially taken a stand on it, and certainly can be in certain cases be put in the evangelical resurgence camp altogether. All right, now what kind of the next quest point then is after that? What kind of evidence is there that we do have an evangelical resurgence taking place at this time? What kind of facts do we have besides, you know, cover stories on Time and Newsweek? As important and as useful as they are, oftentimes, like television, the mass media magazines get caught up with something, and although they have, especially Newsweek, has a very responsible and respected religion editor in Ken Woodward, sometimes we tend to think that a movement exists because Time or Newsweek tells us it does, and it actually doesn't. But I think I've got about seven or eight pieces of evidence here which I would like to go through very briefly, just as information, as a basis for the kind of discussion that we would have here. We like to start with statistics, and of course, statistics can be misleading. There are all kinds of different statistics, but as some of you know, George Gallup Jr. himself is a very dedicated, conscientious Christian, and has spent a good deal of time and effort in collecting statistics on this, and just in another couple of weeks, hopefully, a new book will come out on the latest statistics on religious life in America in 1977. And according to Gallup, at least one out of every three Americans claim to have what we call a born-again experience as evidence of this. And when you project that out to over 210 million total population, that comes out as about 50 million American people. Which is too high, obviously, far too high, but it gives an indication, at least, that the polls do not show a trend in the other direction, but the Gallup poll, which is the best one on this, because Gallup is just about the only one among the important pollsters in this country compared to the others who asks these kinds of questions and argues this sort of thing. Furthermore, for the first time since the middle 1950s, the polls show, and if you get the Yearbook of American Churches published by the NCC, you'll see that there is a beginning of a slight upturn in maybe some of you pastors don't see this, but there is a slight upturn nationally in attendance in church on Sundays. for the first time. It hit bottom about 1970 and stayed there for a while, and it's up about 2% in the last 2 years. The same thing is true not only in attendance, but in enrollment. These are rather, I think, firm or hard statistics that are revealing. A third thing that's very important in indicating this is that, in contrast to other colleges, secular colleges, public universities, and so on, there is a tremendous boom in enrollment in the Bible colleges and in the very conservative church colleges across the country. They have no trouble. I'm talking here about the circuit that would include places like Wheaton in Massachusetts and Fuller, and not Wheaton in Massachusetts, that's a women's college, Wheaton in Illinois. Gordon, that's the one I was thinking of, in Massachusetts, Bethel in North St. Paul, where we're from, and so on. And this tells us something, that people, while others are not going to college or are not able to go to college or whatever, or don't think that the college education is necessarily going to get them a good job, there is a strong increase in enrollment in these colleges. They have really no difficulty in filling up rather early with this. The same thing is true not only in colleges, but in the Christian school movement. And we are at the point now where, at least as far as we can tell, 1 out of every 10 children in this country are attending what we would call an explicit Christian school, which is a large increase over the last 5 years. It's difficult to collect statistics on this because the Christian schools pride themselves on their independence. And one of the things that they pride themselves on is not having a lot of bureaucracy and reporting to any central organization. There is no one central information collecting agency that tells us about all the different, you know, Christian schools that are taking place. There's enormous diversity. There are 4 national Christian school associations, and I've been trying to correspond with all of them, and you know, the statistics get a little bit deceiving here, because some of them like to claim a little bit more than I think actually exists. But nevertheless, the Christian school movement is moving, and I think it's important to notice that it's different than the Christian school movement in the 1960s, because then oftentimes in both southern and northern cities, the Christian school movement was aimed primarily at sending your children to schools where there weren't blacks. And that was very popular, and we had 2 in Minneapolis, for instance, as evidence that I know of, evidence of this. There's no question about this. They just didn't want, you know, racial integration. And even though the quality of education was poorer at the schools, they would rather do that. But that isn't the case any longer. The Christian school movement is growing because, in large part, the parents feel that this thing called secular humanism has crept into the schools. There is a whole battle, some of you in education know, this thing we call values clarification. From good old Dr. Simon, you know, Dr. Simon Says sort of thing. And there is a very strong protest against the values clarification movement, and people want their children to be removed from the kinds of temptations and all the rest that you find there, and they are willing to pay the extra money that the tuition cost to send them there, although there is now a small movement starting, especially in Grand Rapids, where a lot of evangelical movements start, obviously, to have tuition paid for by the state. But I don't think, in terms of the First Amendment, that has a chance. So these are a few statistical pieces of evidence that an evangelical resurgence is taking place. I'll just go through sort of a list here, like a catalog, like we're going through a Sears Roebuck catalog at the time. That there is a tremendous boom of in popularity in television or electronic evangelism. I'll give you just two examples for this. We've had the old diehards, and I don't say that at all critically, Billy Graham, Oral Roberts, Rex Humbard, for instance, going strong, starting in the 50s, going straight through the 60s, and still going strong today, and still having a rather sizable budget. But the last Wall Street Journal that reported on this showed that Pat Robertson, with the 700 Club, has an annual budget of $30 million, and Jim Baker with PTL, People That Love or Praise the Lord, whichever one you want. I used to call it, remember in the old Luther League days, the Pocket Testament League, and I didn't think that the Pocket Testament League had come back. That was from the old ELC days, and so on. But he has a budget of $25 million annually, and in 1971, neither of these people were anywhere in terms of popularity or growth, and now suddenly they have these enormous budgets, which I think is a very significant thing. And I must say, I feel I walk the second mile because I have an extra cycle in the morning, and it's hard enough to get up there and pump and get your pulse beat up to 150, not to at the same time also look at the PTO at the same time. I feel that that's doing double punishment for getting my heart in shape and so on. But I'd be glad to discuss that with some of the rest of you later. That gives away my bias. Honest, but the boom in evangel in this is very strong. Some of you have read Martin Marty's book, but an analysis of this. He's got a marvelous thing about you know, what's happening when you have the young attractive men in pink tuxedos and frilled shirts and all the rest. You know, what does this have to do with the gospel? And Marty knows a good deal about this. And sometime maybe later next week I could talk about electronic evangelism. Another very important sign of the resurgence is the growth in the Christian bookstores that has spread throughout the country. In Minneapolis, for instance, in the last 4 years, a group called the Northwestern Bookstore Association has expanded out into the suburbs. And they're very strong, they're very organized, they're very good as far as organization is concerned, very well planned. They know their business, they know their merchandising. This isn't the old mom and pop thing that's open, you know, from maybe 5 o'clock until 9 and maybe after church on Sunday. But these are very well organized, highly computerized groups who are doing an enormous business and know what the market is and know what kind of books to be written for the market at this time. And this plugs in to the larger scene that I've talked about before. Yesterday we were talking about the self-help movement, and one very good example of this, and I don't say this critically, but just simply as an illustration, would be the books of Jess Lehrer. You know, I ain't much God, but I'm all I've got, which is evangelical in tone, but which is also very much a self-help kind of book. And, you know, they're selling very, very well, and others that you can mention with this. But besides the bookstore, another thing that that indicates the growing popularity of the evangelical resurgence, if, and I'm sure most of you have seen these, is the technique of merchandising evangelical books in mass outlets, especially in supermarkets and in drugstores, because these are family centers, and it's very easy to convince a grocer or a drugstore manager or whatever else that they should have something besides the usual trash and nonsense and all the rest that go along with this, and they have books which are available which people otherwise wouldn't buy. You don't find a lot of people necessarily going out of their way to go to an evangelical bookstore, like the one that I'm the most familiar with is the one in downtown Minneapolis on 9th and Hennepin, which is having some trouble with its neighbors, if you know what's happening to 9th and Hennepin in Minneapolis. It's an anomaly to see a Christian bookstore right next to it. Well, anyway, we'll skip that. But the point is that they are going out and bringing books to people where the people are, and it's working, and it's working very well, and it's an indication of the attempt to reach a mass market. Now, besides the boom in schools, besides the bookstore thing and the Christian schools, another very important element in the evangelical resurgence today is what I call the evangelical celebrity, who is very, very important. And oftentimes the movement depends really on a strong, attractive personality, as I suggested before. And so far as I can tell, there are sort of two kinds of evangelical celebrities who are very attractive to the public today, and I want to talk about here briefly, and I like to use alliteration here, and of course, probably the three best known would be Jimmy Carter, you know, Eldridge Cleaver, and Charles Colson, the three C's, along with this. And I won't go into an analysis of their works, but all of these have given the public the impression that it is no longer sort of square or backward or kind of foolish to talk openly about being born again. This is one question I would like to ask for a discussion a little bit later, because we used to ridicule, you know, at St. Olaf we used to call them the Holy Olies, right, and I'm sure, you know, all the rest of the Bible thumpers, my father-in-law used to call them, or the Holy Jumpers, or whatever else, and now it's not at all unusual, obviously, since we see it every day, for celebrities to make a very strong kind of witness with this. Others would be Ruth Carter Stapleton, and she just made the cover of Newsweek, was it, 2 weeks ago, and so on, and they don't have, well, you get the idea with this. They have had some trouble with, and Paul asked me to mention this, and so I will. They have had some trouble with some celebrities who have had the born-again experience, especially Larry Flint from the Hustler magazine, which has to be the pits, you know, of all of the bad magazines. I took a look once at the airport, and I think, you know, I've been in the Army and different things, but I've never seen anything like the Hustler, and I was ashamed. The first thing I did was to see if anybody was watching me, because... even the President of the United States, even Anita Bryant, even Martin Marty have published in, you know, in Playboy, but Hustler is pretty bad. And Larry Flint has supposedly had a born-again experience, except when they had the National Broadcasters Association convention in Washington this spring, they were going to have him on as, you know, we really bagged the big one this time when we got Larry Flint, but they had to keep him off the program when they found out ahead of time that he was going to say that he was going to put a centerfold of Mary Magdalene, you know, in the next issue. Somehow, as somebody said very politely, Larry Flint needs nurture. And I think that's the best way to look at it. He needs a lot of nurture. And the same thing is true with Cleaver. Cleaver was going to go in front, only he had gotten into a clothing industry, and he was putting forward a trousers that had a symbol of a cod, let's just say, in the wrong place. Cleaver probably needs a little bit more nurture with this sort of thing. All right, but you've got the celebrity evangelicals who talk and reach a wide audience in what I would call a very general way. They're talking about the born again experience, and, you know, and as I said yesterday with Colson and the rest, they're completely sincere, and I think can only do good with this. That's one kind. But also, what's happening in our country with the fragmentation and the balkanization that I talked about yesterday was that we have another group of celebrity evangelicals who limit themselves primarily to one issue, not the generality kind, like Colson. Well, Colson, of course, talks a lot about prison reform, and there's an enormous amount of work to be done there. And I think, isn't he full-time, in fact, in the prison rehabilitation? He's devoted himself full-time to that, which is about as thankless, a cause or a crusade as there is, and one which, you know, only elicits enormous, admiration, I think, on the part of all of us. But there is a second group who are important and are able to shape and lead opinion because they have zeroed in on one specific issue. And I'll just mention these without going through the details on these, and then we can go on to some of the others. And of course, probably the one who is best known would be Anita Bryant, and the Anita Bryant story, who comes in, but who has limited herself primarily to the one issue, the gay issue. Or another celebrity who has become very popular, but still a one-issue person, is Maribel Morgan. Or a third one would be Phyllis Schlafly on the anti-ERA. Although, if you take the Phyllis Schlafly report, you see that she branches off from time to time because her record in conservative economic and political and social issues goes way, way back. She was the one, if some of you have forgotten, who wrote the book A Choice, Not an Echo in 1964, which was pro-Goldwater sort of thing with this. All right. So what I'm suggesting here with the evangelical resurgence is that we have new kinds of role models who know and understand their audiences very well. I have a whole chapter on Maribel as a very successful businesswoman. All the other ideas about saran wrap and all the rest of the things aside, she knows what works and she knows what sells, and it is about as slick and smooth an operation as you find anywhere. But on the other hand, I said I wasn't going to talk about it, but here I go. On the other hand, she's found an audience and she's found a need that some other groups aren't meeting, and that's important because there are people who don't know where the answers are, and she is being able to reach those. So you have, I think, two groups of celebrities, and there's a couple other generalizations to make about them that I think that are important. And one is that they are all sort of above denominations. You don't find any kind of loyalty to the denominations in any of these at all. I think Colson's Episcopalian, if I'm not mistaken, but if at least that's where he started. But you don't find that explicitly mentioned. The same thing is true, with all the others, which tells us something important, I think, about what's happening in American church life, and that is, in this evangelical resurgence, it is not a denominational loyalty kind of battle that's taking place. Marty started this in his book called The Nation of Behaviors, in which he finds that denominational loyalty or denominational battles, with some exceptions, and some very important exceptions, obviously, but denominational loyalty is on the wane rather than on the wax. And he says that you can better identify what's going on in American church life now by various kinds of behavior that's taking place rather than commitments to the Westminster Creed or to the 39 Articles in Anglicanism or the Augsburg Confession or the rest of these things, or by what part of the country you live in. It's a very good book, you can learn a lot about American church life by reading it. Martin Marty, a Nation of Behaviors. Of behaviors all the way through. All right. So I think then these would be my pieces of evidence as to the fact that by comparison to even 4 or 5 years ago, an evangelical revival or resurgence of a certain type is taking place. There's no one specific time there in which you can say it happened. Like you can really with Billy Graham in 1949 when he had his famous sermon in Los Angeles. When he announced that the Russians had 3 atomic bombs and they were going to drop one on New York, one on Chicago, and one on Los Angeles. And you better believe that William Randolph Hearst had that on the front page the next day. And it got into Life magazine. And you can really date the Billy Graham thing from that point on, but you can't really date this one at any one time. There's no grand opening party or cutting ribbons or anything, but generally they say 1976 because of the election of Jimmy Carter. It could well be, but anyway, it's certainly well underway at this time. All right. Now, what I'd like to do next is to suggest very briefly how this is connected with the larger scene and some of the important cultural movements and trends that are taking place in America at this time. The thesis that I'm proposing in the book is given in the title. I'm calling it, the editor hasn't approved this yet, and you'd appreciate that sometimes editors sometimes have ways of, my editor, I don't know what luck you had, but my editor had a wonderful way of when he disagrees with me, he doesn't say no right away, but he keeps talking. And by golly, within 15 or 20 minutes, guess who's won, with us, and the circuitous way. And he's made me feel as though I've made the decision. And I go away feeling fine. Roland, that's right. Boy, that's the right decision. And he had it in mind all the way, But that's a sign of a good editor. Maybe sometimes if any of you have been in counseling, I don't know anything about counseling, but maybe in counseling some of you probably know that's the best way of doing things altogether. But the title is what I call holding forth or pressing on. The idea of either holding forth to that which is good or pressing on to the higher prize. And then I call it the evangelical search for authority in a world coming apart. And the suggestion there is that, and this ties in with this premillennial eschatology that I talked about before, that many people read the signs of the times. And these aren't just the old groups who used to find all kinds of symbolism, 666 and the book of Daniel. And I know my mentor and close friend Cliff Nelson says that the book of Daniel is a happy hunting ground for more, predictors about the end of the world than you can find anywhere else, or reading certain passages in Revelation. But a lot of people are really convinced that the end times are very close, if not here right now. And that they look at wars, you look at Lebanon and, so many different places. You look at terrorism, which is certainly on the increase. You look at natural disasters. You look at food shortages. Earthquakes, you look at man-made things such as the increase in vice and crime, illegitimacy in this country, a whole raft of arguments and pieces of evidence can be put forward to suggest that the world is getting worse. And of course, this is the premillennial scheme, that the world has to get worse before Christ will come for the Battle of Armageddon. And that in one way, it's amusing because for those who are into the premillennial position, the worse the world gets, the happier they are, because that means the closer Jesus is to coming again with this. And if I found this out when I did my book on Carl McIntyre, that he would say that when he got out of the, when he walked out of the house in the morning, he would look up in the sky and hope to see Jesus, literally, you know, coming in. Just like if you remember, some of you, the older ones, if you saw the movie La Dolce Vita, remember that opening that the director used when they had the helicopter carrying a statue of Jesus, you know, being you know, flown right over Rome, the eternal city, as a symbol of judgment on what was taking place in Rome at the time. But I think the evangelical movement is popular because there are many people who are looking at the world, and especially we could talk about the energy crisis too and the running out of resources, and believing that maybe you know, some of the prophecies of the end times are really coming true. And when you look at the headlines, like I was saying yesterday, the time we watched the Walter Cronkite news, and after 20 minutes we were all, you know, broken down because it was nothing but grief with this. And I think the evangelical movement plugs into that, that the doomsday people who are suggesting that the world is really in a crisis out of which it probably can't extricate itself. And I think the evangelical movement is important also because, as I was talking about yesterday, we no longer feel that, you know, through political action we can really solve the great issues any longer. We don't have the great crusades that we had in the 1960s. And what we've done, you know, as I talked about, was balkanization, turn inward. And if you know the people I was talking about, you see what they're all talking about. They're talking about preserving and saving and holding on to those parts of their life that are the closest to them. You can't do anything about energy, but you can do something about your marriage. You can't do really much about depletion of resources, but you can do something about your children. You can't do much you know, about some other inflation. But you can do something about, you know, renewing serious commitment to, you know, Bible study and this sort of thing within the congregation itself. So the self-help movement is very much a part of the evangelical resurgence thing. If we can't save the world, at least we can save ourselves. And it's interesting too, and I've listened to Billy Graham carefully since he started. And he no longer, and I don't say this by way of criticism, he no longer talks about saving America. In the 1950s, he was going to, you know, I've got all the sermons, he was going to save America. Or in 1957, the famous revival in New York, he was going to come in all seriousness, he was going to save New York City. You know, these grandiose kinds of ideas. No longer do they talk about that. Now they talk about preserving what is the closest and the dearest to them, because they can't do anything else about this and about the larger problems. And also what they are searching for and what these strong, attractive celebrities are giving them, you see, is a sense of authority, which they missed before. Because in the 1960s, especially with things like situation ethics, for instance, where, you know, whatever you do, do in love and it's okay, became very popular. Or Harvey Cox, you remember, was talking about the kingdom of God is in the city, while many people believed, you know, that the city was about the end of civilization rather than the beginning. And if any of you have been in Times Square recently, you begin to suspect that maybe it is the end of civilization, and so on. But the point I'm trying to make here is that it's a part of the larger movement in which there is a search for authority, a search for answers which are clear, which are precise, which are trustworthy, and which will be able to cope with the problems which are the closest to the people themselves, not being able any longer to deal with larger issues. It's just, you know, sort of overwhelming. I know I had this experience just briefly traveling through Thailand when I saw, you know, the enormous poverty and the tremendous odds against any kind of significant change or improvement taking place. 80% of the people were suffering from malnutrition, and this isn't the worst sort of thing. And people give up, and you know, they move in. All right. Now, so far as my own very brief personal analysis is concerned, I would like to say just two quick things and then ask some questions here. I think the movement itself is both backward-looking on the one hand and forward-looking on the other, which is not exactly an original, you know, kind of statement, but it's backward because it is in large part a backlash against much of the culture, especially the counterculture of the 60s. Because there were many who felt in the 1960s that the world was coming apart. And I think some of you who remember watching the Democratic National Convention that one night in 1968 really felt that the world, I felt it very strongly, the world, you know, or America is simply coming apart. We saw all the things. And you remember Senator Ribicoff's statement and then Daley booing him and the cops, you know, and Humphrey using St. Francis of Assisi's prayer and all of these things. I really felt, you know, that something terrible was happening. And this was after the assassination of King, after the assassination of Bobby, after the blow-up at Columbia University in which two people were killed, you know, the whole kind of thing. And this got all lumped together, you see, as a counterculture, as signs, you see, of the coming of the end times, connected with, you know, with long hair, with sexual freedom, with dope, with rock, with communes. All the while that was taking place, this movement towards the counterculture in the 60s, there was the undercurrent, the backlash, which Vice President Agnew understood very well and was able to appeal to with his various kinds of alliterative kinds of speeches. He forgot to turn off some of his sources of support, though. That was his only trouble during this period. There's one thing to denounce the hippies. Well, anyway, I don't want to get started on it. He's out of it, and he's paid his debt. All right. It's backward-looking in that, you see, in the search for authority, it is a deliberate attempt to prevent the kind of, you know, Woodstock culture, you're using Woodstock as a symbol, from ever appearing again with this. And you find this, for instance, in Phyllis Schlafly, who in her reports will sometimes not have any sort of written analysis at all, but will show an ERA parade, and she will use only pictures of the you know, the lesbian groups, and that's it. And or some who have, or obviously are stoned or whatever, who are into the movement, and therefore appealing to the memories of the 60s as this. And in that particular sense, I think it's a backlash. And it's time for America, you know, to get straightened out again. And it's forward-looking on the other hand, and it's optimistic because with the evangelistic thrust, and I'm not, you know, shortchanging that at all, with the evangelistic thrust of saving souls, it's optimistic because it believes that there still is time in America for this to be done. That time hasn't run out completely in America. But what is necessary now is not the major, large-scale kinds of demonstrations and programs that are there any longer, but there is still time for the one-to-one kind of evangelism, which is popular in this country. So to sum up, the kind of revival that we're in today is not the kind of revival that we're familiar with from American history, from the old days of Jonathan Edwards and George Whitefield, Dwight L. Moody and Ira Sankey and Billy Sunday. It's not even like the Billy Graham revivals of the 1950s at all. But it is one in which it has made its peace in certain ways with the world, and still, on the other hand, is trying to preserve what they think is possible to preserve. And my own feeling, so far as the future of the movement is concerned, is that it's going to be an uphill battle because, maybe it's just because I am in kind of a pessimistic mood lately, but I think the forces, and this, I hope we'll get a discussion going, I think the forces of secularism in this country are becoming so strong and so powerful despite what the only person I know who disagrees with this is Andrew Greeley, and if you read him, you know he disagrees with everything. Despite what Andrew Greeley says, the Christian Church, especially in America, is going to be an increasing minority, and I think it's going to decline in terms of numbers. It's going to decline in terms of influence. I don't think, my own feeling is if there's any really much doubt about that, but I'd be glad to discuss that with you. And therefore, since this is the case, what is left then is to hold on to and preserve by recapturing a sense of authority, and this is why the inerrancy question in the Bible is back again, by this new sense of authority and rededication to preserve those things that are closest to us, and you know, and hope and pray and wait from that point on. And so I would like to, or wherever I have them here, ask for your response, your kinds of questions, your reactions to this. Yeah.
When you say forces of secularism, what are you thinking about?
Simply materialistic hedonism, to use a big term here. Spending money for Winnebago trailers would be a classic example. And I have a cousin who owns the company, so I'm a little bit, John Hanson down in Forest City. But anyway, that sort of thing, or Sunday mornings really are not, you know, the Sabbath anymore. I mean, mainly the idea that we are entitled to pleasure, we are entitled to spend the money, the discretionary income we have, for our own pursuits, rather than respond to, you know, good, I mean, solid discipleship that goes on. And the preoccupation with clothes, for instance, and with gourmet eating would be another example of this, and with houses. I'm in Burnsville, and I've never seen such a... Well, you all know what's happened to, you know, the prices of houses, but people are willing to pay this. They're willing to pay 10% interest right now for their mortgages because they feel they're entitled to a good home. And if you've got enough material possessions, you know, that's what I mean by that kind of secularism, rather than taking any kind of idea that discipleship, you know, comes first. Yeah.
I didn't hear you say anything about the influence of the church growth movement, which came to the United States in the 70s from England, and now was especially promoted by Fuller Seminary Church Growth Institutes. And I think that's all mixed up with this fundamentalist fad, and based on very definite sociological principles, like that like seeks like, that it's better to have all blacks in one church and all whites in the other church and all upper middle class in this church, and start a Chinese-speaking church and a Hispanic-speaking, and not try to mix people up. And then also based on some strong institutional principles, and that is the absolute authority of the pastor. And that pastor, that the congregation must not be set up democratically. And one of the first things you do if you're going to move into that whole church growth fundamentalist thing is dissolve all committees, and the pastor becomes the sole authority and appoints whatever committee he wants, which makes it a little difficult then institutionally, yes, where you're set up on a democratic.
Yeah, I could buy, you know, getting rid of some of the, you know, facetiously some of the committees, but you're right, absolutely right on this. And what happened in the charismatic movement, and it really isn't over yet, was a huge blow up. Some of you might remember this 2 years ago over the question of discipleship. It was quieted down because the leaders didn't want it to get out into the public. But when we had a journal called National Courier, they had a couple of reporters, and Bill Torkelson from the Star were courageous enough to go in and find out what was going on here. And there was a big blow up over this discipleship sort of thing. Bob Mumford would be the best example of this. And the Catholics had some terrible trouble with Ann Arbor and South Bend and all the rest with discipleship. And it's submerged now. We don't talk about it, but you're right with the authority of the pastor sort of thing that's coming.
The church growth movement is snowballing.
Yes.
And success and growth.
Yes.
Becoming the goal.
Very much the numbers game. Very, very much so. I'm going to talk next week on success, and the numbers game, building big cathedrals in places that you know quite well.
Like Garden Grove.
Like Garden Grove, yeah.
We're 3 miles from it, so we're the mirror.
Yeah, you're the mirror, right. You get the reflection, right.
Do you group these in any way with the evangelical movement, the success?
Lauder, do I group these with the success? I don't quite understand.
Well, the Schulers and so forth.
Well, I don't put Schuler is a world apart from. I mean, there's so many things that can be said in so many ways with Schuler. He has the Bethel Bible series, doesn't he?
Yes, as a base for all of his officers.
Yeah. And you know, but that
the
just
church,
you know,
growth movement quotes him with a smile of approval.
Yeah, yeah. I read Bill Bachelman's piece in Christian Century, and you know, and I had some real doubts. And then 2 years ago, we had a man, a pastor from near there, who said some things about Schuler. And then when I found, and I had made up my mind pretty much, and then I heard that he used Bethel Bible Series, and, you know, I just threw up my hands. And then...
I always thought Shuler reflected California.
Well, he's got...
California does things in a big way, you know.
Christian humanism.
Yeah. What's the one I mentioned yesterday? That rejoice, my friends, leap up, or else cry in sorrow. What California is today, America will be tomorrow.
After this last election, the cry part, I think, fits much better than
yeah.
the
and we just got proper. We could have a good forum next week on two blockbusters that came from California, Proposition 13 and the Bakke decision. But anyway, you're right. Thank you on the growth, the church growth thing. That's very strong. The idea of the authority of the pastor. And that's a real regression, because that goes back to Jehovah's Witness, it goes back to Assemblies of God, it goes back to Seventh-day Adventist sort of thing. And that's kind of frightening. On the other hand, some congregations, and maybe some of you pastors would comment on this, I think are in trouble, and maybe that's this, I think Carter's in trouble, because the pastor has to be a regular guy. And he has to mingle and be simply one more person, and there has to be sort of an equalitarian tendency here. And if he has any, quote, uppity airs, then something's wrong with him. But if he's one of the boys and can sit down and have a beer with, you know, out at the country club with the rest of them, then he's okay. And that removes a certain kind of leadership, I think, that's necessary. It's a very fine line there. Inky? Oh, in front. Okay.
Do you have any thoughts on Bill Gothard?
Many. And, well, the best book, and I draw strictly here from Bill Bockelman's book, and I it's on order. Did it come, John?
I'm not sure.
I ordered it. I'll be glad to give you the address afterwards. Bockelman, who works in the Department of Communications, the ALC, made a very careful study of Gothard, and I also have a wonderful piece written in the Lutheran Standard in 1974, as only Elmo Agrimson could write a piece on Gothard, and it's just a little gem. If you have to know Agrimson to know, you know, that he is not exactly the circuitous type that goes around an issue with this, and so I draw largely from Bockelman's thing and the rest, and he said so far what it comes down to. Yes, so far as principles on rearing children are concerned, he was sold. They were all solid, they were biblically based, and they were all very much to be commended. But his trouble with Gothard was that Gothard sees the Bible as an answer book. That, and I've gone through the thing. Well, I've got the big red spiral book and all the rest, and somehow. You see, the Bible has a specific, direct answer for every question that comes up, and it all fits together. And that you can leap from Micah to Titus, without any difficulty. You line up eight ways to do this. It's the old cult of positive thinking in this country. There are eight ways to solve this problem, six ways to deal with that. Sounds like, you know, Norman Vincent Peale sort of thing. And when the Bible becomes an answer book rather than an encounter, you see, that's the point. And that's what Bill is trying to stress in his book, where you go for answers rather than for, you know, meeting Christ personally in that way. Then Bockelman becomes suspicious, and I've plowed through the whole thing, and I think that would be the major objection that comes through with Gothard with this. And there is certainly far more law than gospel in Gothard, if you want to use a Lutheran critique with this. Sort of thing. But on the other hand, he's doing something right because he's packing in 40,000 people once a year into the St. Paul Auditorium. Meeting some kind of need there and another thing, he's contrary to what I said before, he's not a good public speaker. There's nothing flashy or, you know, spectacular. Very low key. There's no hoopla. There are no lowered lights. There's nothing else like this kind of thing with him. He's small and he doesn't wear the most flashy. He doesn't have a three-piece suit, you know, and all the rest. And yet he can sit there and lecture for 3 hours and hold people, except for a 20-minute break, you know, and enthralled. And they keep coming back. About 50% of his audience comes back year after year. Paul,
you just said, I think. He must be doing something right because he packs 40,000 people into the auditorium.
Yeah, the numbers game, yeah.
I was wondering why you are surprised at the numbers game.
Well, because I say that, I think you're right. Paul likes to twiddle me, and that's one reason I keep coming back here. Paul keeps me honest, but anyway, at least thinking that when somebody with no advertising—that's another thing—with no advertising, none whatsoever. It's all mouth to mouth. There's no ads in the Saturday Night Minneapolis Star that like there is for the Minneapolis Gospel Tabernacle with Smiling Bob Peterson or whatever. That there's nothing else like this in Gothard. It's all word of mouth, and he brings them in. And when you can do it that way, what that means is that people are telling other people that Gothard has met some needs. And that he doesn't rely, you see, on the kind of hype or promo that that somebody like Maribel uses. And by that I mean he must be doing something, in the sense that when people tell other people to come along, that means that says something important, because it's very easy to fool people through mass merchandising the way Maribel is able to do, but Gothard has something else, yeah.
Well, you happened to make your remark just when I was trying to feel good because we Presbyterians are fast becoming a remnant.
A remnant, oh. Yeah.
A faithful remnant.
A faithful remnant, right, in the back.
I heard a pastor speak just before the first time I attended Bill Gothard's meeting, and he said if he had to trade or make the choice between his seminary training and what he got from Bill Gothard, he'd take Bill Gothard. And I found a number of people that I thought had something to go on making a statement, something like that. Of course, Bill Gothard isn't perfect.
Yeah.
He has, as you say, filled a need for some people in some areas.
Yeah, right. And I have, but if you look at it very carefully and analyze it very carefully, he's very loyal to the scripture, it isn't that, but it's the idea that whatever problem comes up in life, the Bible has a, there's no ambiguity. And he's not Lutheran, so in that way, because that there's a direct, specific answer, and he, it's a proof text, way of exegesis. You can stitch together a verse from here and a stitch together a verse from there, and take them out of context, and that's what I would disagree with this, and it's what I call code morality. You remember Benjamin Franklin was trying to improve himself, and he practiced one virtue a week for 12 weeks, and he cultivated these. And then after he got through the 12, he realized he had slipped a little bit at number one, so he started over again. And it can get into that, and that's what I'm afraid of.
Of course, that's one growing power, isn't it? We'd all like a cookbook method.
Yes.
So we could say, here's the answer.
And that's, right, and that's where Bachelman has a Lutheran critique, and I think it's a very good one, and I'm perfectly happy to give him all the credit for it, yeah.
I thought that Bill Gothard rather laid out principles.
When it comes up with something like, let's say, premarital sex, that it's which is a very specific kind of problem, it's not only the principle, but when you read it and in the context that he has with it, there's no question that there is only one answer for this, or let's say euthanasia. Or other problems like this, or the most controversial one, I think, is the matter of disciplining children. He doesn't show in 20th century language what the answer is, but the verse that he uses leaves no doubt in the minds of the people exactly what he means. Spare the rod and spoil the child, kind of thing. Pinky.
Did you see the outcome of this sort of a backlash against the church?
Yeah. If anybody feels the need for coffee as I do, please feel free to. I'll stay all day, really. I
get the hint.
No, I thrive on this. I mean, you're resource people here, Inky.
No, I'm just wondering if you saw the future sort of a backlash against Christianity in the church.
Well, I see it not. You see, what's happened in contrast to, let's say, the 20s, is that people are no longer hostile towards the church. They're no longer hostile towards the evangelicals. They're indifferent. People
are going to see that it doesn't work, all this evangelical business, so no time for the church.
Yeah, but
from your position as a historian, do you see the church's task, in a sense, as this comes on?
Yeah, I think, and I didn't have time to go into this, it's the answer that I used also with the study on the charismatic is follow-up and the local congregation. And that's very hard, but I think that's where it has to be. And if there's any criticism of Billy Graham, it's been that in some cases, not in all, but in some cases, there hasn't been the persistent follow-up on the local congregational level. Graham tries hard, and I'm not criticizing, because Graham realized that at the beginning, Graham was simply another sawdust tent preacher, you know, save him tonight and that's it, and then tomorrow night we can bring in another crowd. But then he began to get, he got popular and influential, and so he developed a very good, I think, follow-up program. But the danger here is no congregational follow-up. And one trouble is that what happens in the evangelical born-again experience is that the day-by-day life in the congregation is so dull compared to the ecstasy of the moment of, you know, the hour I first believed kind of thing. I'll give you a wonderful example. One reason I like being in Northfield is that they have a retired ministers association, and to be able to talk to pastors with 40 years experience is a real privilege and a joy because of all the experience and the insight that these men have, and they love to talk. And I come about once a year with my research. And we got talking to Billy Graham once, and I think I told one of you, I guess it was you or somebody here, about this wonderful old pastor, about Billy Graham. And he said, yeah, some of us spend, I can't do the Norwegian accent the way he did, but he said, some of us spend all our life planting the seeds, and then somebody else comes along and reaps all the harvest, you know. Marty makes a point about electronic evangelism is that what happens is that with these spectacular shows with bubbly fountains, and guess, you know, who I'm referring to there, you know, and all these other things, and men in pink, you know, tuxedos, and girls in, you know, long fancy gowns and all the rest, and suddenly they have to go to the local congregation where the choir is off key and the sermon isn't very good. And they're struggling to make the budget, and all the grief and the pettiness and the nonsense that goes on with that. Where the danger is with the hype, or the hyperbole is what I mean, the flashiness, because people are not willing to work it out on the gutsy local level where it really has to be done, and they can sit in their armchairs on Sunday morning with their Danish and all the rest, and see a spectacular. And it's all in harmony and eight-part color and, you know, whatever else, all of these things. And where I see is a real danger to the local congregation.